Welcome to More Than Just Mom, formerly known as the Mom Forum Podcast. I'm your host, Alicia Beach. I am the birth mom of three, adoptive mom of one, and stepmom of four. Yep, you heard that right, eight kids. I'm basically a professional mom, complete with a BA in child development. And being a mom to all of those kids, I have realized over the years that it is so easy to lose yourself to motherhood. And it's become an important part of my journey to see myself as more than just mom. And on this podcast, I will be having conversations with other moms, experts, and sharing my own journey in order to support and empower women as individuals so that we can all remind ourselves that we are more than just mom. On this episode of More Than Just Mom, we are continuing our series on race, racism, and race relations through the lens of motherhood. And I am sitting down with two fellow bloggers and also good friends who are white moms raising white children. I thought it was really important for us to have a conversation and get a different perspective about the murder of George Floyd, race relations right now in the United States, and their experiences and biases that come along with growing up as a white woman in America and raising white children in America. Now, I ask that, again, you listen to this episode knowing that they are not a monolithic representation of white women. They are sharing their own personal experiences. And again, I also ask that you come to this conversation with an open heart, an open mind, and open ears. Thank you guys for joining me for another episode of More Than Just Mom. I am here with two amazing mamas and fellow bloggers, and they are going to join me for a different perspective of this race conversation. And I'm going to have them introduce themselves to us. Carly, let's start with you.
Hey. I don't even know what to say. I am Carly. I live in San Diego. I am the mom of one daughter who is six, almost seven, very important. I am a former teacher. I primarily blog about empowering ourselves and our daughters and how we can do that through parenting and everyday life.
Fabulous. And Summer?
Hi, I'm Summer. I have a blog called The Dirty Floor Diaries, but I'm mainly on Instagram nowadays. I have three kids and we live in LA, which stands for Lower Alabama. It's a very interesting place over here. And I mainly focus on family life. I want to empower my daughter to believe that she is beautiful no matter what her body looks like and to know that she is super, super strong in every way a woman can be that way.
And these ladies are being very humble. They are both award-winning bloggers and content creators. So I absolutely adore both of them and look up to them. And just to tell you a little bit about me, I am from LA, but the polar opposite of Summer's LA. I live in Los Angeles, but I am from Alabama, grew up in Birmingham, and I have four children of my own and four stepkids. And I am married to an actor. So I live a bit of a crazy life. But I wanted to have this conversation. You guys know in the episode prior to this, and if you haven't listened to it, you must. I sat down with three friends of mine that we are all members of a group called Mocha Moms, which focuses on supporting Black mothers. And now I am sitting down with Carly and Summer, who are both white moms. And I wanted to have a different perspective in this conversation around race, which if you happen to be listening to this at a different time, we are in the midst of a global pandemic around COVID-19. We were We saw the death of George Floyd back in June. And since then, we have had a number of protests worldwide around race and police brutality. And it has been a lot to digest, to say the least. And it is my belief that the best thing that we can do with all of this is to have some real conversations. So I wanted to use my podcast to really sit down and talk to moms about their perspectives, because I think we are a huge link in changing these conversations and really having some honest talk about this. So let's just start with getting kind of your reaction to when you saw the George Floyd video and how you felt about that. If you even watched the whole thing, because it was sent to me and I watched it having no idea what it was. And unfortunately, I think we've become a little numb to seeing police brutality in videos. And I have to admit, my first reaction was, oh my gosh, another one of these. And then I got to a certain point in the video and was completely sickened and couldn't watch it any further. But I'm curious to hear how you guys reacted to it. And maybe Summer, we can start with you.
Sure. I could not watch the whole thing. I think I watched maybe the first quarter of the video. I knew what the outcome was going to be, and I was physically ill and crying within the first just, you know, couple seconds of watching. It was before the expanded one had come out. It was kind of a shorter version that started where the police officer already had his knee on George Floyd's neck. And I was just disgusted that the police officer was standing there with a smug look on his face with his hands in his pockets and kneeling on this black man. It was disgusting. And I couldn't watch the rest of it.
Yeah.
I have to say, I have tried to watch the video all the way through a number of times, and I make it about halfway and just can't watch the entire video. Of course, we all know at this point what happened, right? But it still somehow shocks me to the point where I can't finish the video every time, every single time. Yeah.
I feel like I know what happens. I don't need to watch it. Like I can see enough in that small amount of time to know that what this police officer did was 100% wrong.
Right. Right.
And to like watch someone's life leave their body, just, I honestly don't know if like I could deal.
I think the thing that I kept feeling, especially when the video really first came out and started to really cycle through the news a lot, was I knew what the police did was wrong. That wasn't even a question. It was that I felt like I needed to watch the video. I felt like I had to learn something. I don't know if that makes any sense, but yeah. I felt like there was something I needed to learn from the video, which is why I kept trying to watch it. And after a point, I realized the thing I needed to learn was probably not in that video. There were a lot of things I needed to learn, but it wasn't that. It was like, right. Okay, I have processed what happens in this video. I need to spend my energy learning other things about what is being discussed right now versus the video itself.
Yeah. It is it's such a hard thing to look at. And I hate to say this, but I think because it was so hard, it's why everything got ignited, because it was such a horrid act, which is absolutely horrible that a man had to lose his life over that. But we were in this midst of everyone, you know, being still and having been in their homes for 3 months at the time. And, you know, it was just like, everybody was there to see it, and it became something that was now unavoidable. Like you couldn't be brushed under the rug, because, you know, as a black woman, I see these kind of things all the time, and I'm very aware of, you know, Philando Castile and all the so many Sandra I can't remember her last name right now, and Breonna Taylor. And you hear these stories over and over and over, and it's almost like I absorb it, and it's kind of like, this is what happens. But I'm curious, as white women, if you were aware of these kind of things going on, was it that much in your face, or did this kind of like shake you and wake you up?
I think for me, I was very aware. I was a teacher for 15 years in inner city schools in Los Angeles. And just to be blunt, I only taught students of color. I saw many interactions that my students and their parents had with law enforcement. Some were good, and I think it's important to say that. They weren't all bad, but some were terrifying and frustrating and confusing. And I saw their families have experiences that, frankly, my family is never going to have. They're just not. Mm-hmm. But that was at like a very magnified, up close level. These were families that I had personal relationships with. And I think on some level, I also needed to think about the fact that it was so much bigger than what I was seeing up close, that this, what I see up close is happening everywhere. So was it a surprise? No. Was it a reminder to me that this is a problem that needs to be addressed in a much bigger way? Yes.
Yeah. And it was a reminder to me as well. It's not something that I'm naive to the fact that exists. A great deal of my friends are Black, and we talk about this often. I want to know that they're okay. I want to know their stories. And it's been important to me since I was pretty young to recognize that my path through this world looks a lot different than my friends of color. And because of that, it's something that I have recognized for a long time. However, I live in an area where it is not recognized. I think people here don't think that racism exists, or that police brutality exists, or that there's any sort of bias that's happening in police departments. I live in a very homogenous community, mostly white people. And that was hard because there were more people talking about it that haven't talked about it before. There were a lot of people actually. There was one thing that was great, and that was that I'm kind of shunned in this community because I have been vocal about these issues in the past, and people here don't want to hear about it. It doesn't exist to them, or, you know, they're like, oh, people just play the race card. So because I haven't stood for that and I have fought back, a lot of people don't talk to me. And some of those people were, I saw them crawling out of the woodworks on social media, recognizing that, oh, maybe this is a problem. And so I was able to engage in conversation with those people, which I felt was a huge step forward. So that was how it impacted kind of my community. But for me, it wasn't like a brand new thing. It's a thing that I absolutely hate to see over and over and over again. And I wish that I wasn't surprised that it keeps happening. But every single time I'm like, really, this again? Why? Yeah.
We're still here. We're still here. Yeah,
exactly.
And I think before, like you hear a lot of people say, oh, there's no police brutality because you're Black, da-da-da. But it's, or even like racism doesn't exist nowadays. And it's because it's not their experience. And so it's often like hard to imagine that that is something that other people experience. And I think this episode, this murder of George Floyd has just like busted those doors open for all these conversations to happen. Like, even in talking with my mom, like my mom's white, and she married a Black man and raised Black children in Alabama. But even she has admitted that she's just not aware of some things because it's not her experience. Like, she didn't grow up with the idea of having to deal with someone discriminating against her because of the color of her skin. She never really experienced that until she was with my father. And that really changed her perspective. And I'm curious if you guys had any interactions with racism growing up and how that maybe shaped your perspective, your experience when it comes to racism, or if you were just, that was not my life and it didn't happen until I was older.
So it's very interesting because I would have had a different answer for you a week and a half ago than I have right now. I grew up in Northern California in an extremely liberal community. I mean, where I grew up, they literally pride themselves on being the most liberal county in the United States. I mean, I joke that it's like where hippies go once they make money to like live their best lives. So I would have told you that there were classism issues. There were issues of people receiving treatment because of potentially like how much money their family had. But I would have told you no when it came to the racism. However, where I grew up was primarily white. I went on a scholarship to a private high school in the town next to mine where I grew up. And this high school prides itself even more so on how inclusive and diverse they are. So last week I found an Instagram account that was created by alumni, students, and teachers of color talking about their experiences at this high school. And it was it shocked me. It utterly shocked me. There are no dates. So I don't know how much of this was, this school's been open since like the 60s. Now, some of it was obviously now based on like pop culture references and stuff. Mm-hmm. Some was obviously much older, but it led me to think, oh my gosh, was this going on? And I had zero awareness it was happening. Because I think it was. And it's so ironic because even a couple of weeks ago, I was telling my husband about how amazing this diverse, inclusive high school was that I went to. And I was wrong. It's not that I was wrong. It's that I only knew it from my perspective. And as a teenager, I never questioned what that perspective was. I was thinking about overt racism. I wasn't thinking about microaggressions. I wasn't thinking about comments or who did you sit with at lunch or all the, of those type of things. I was thinking, well, no one hung a Confederate flag. So it made me think about that very differently. And I also have been thinking a lot about the parts of the country that consider ourselves to be very diverse and liberal. We often make assumptions that there's no racism there, and that is not the case. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of one of the many issues that are going on right now, is that for the first time, these dialogues are happening about places where we didn't have them before. You know, no one had an issue admitting that in the Deep South, people are racist, right? People have a lot of issue admitting they are in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah. My mother lives in Northern California. She grew up there right outside of Tahoe. But she was saying she went to a discussion group in her neighborhood after everything happened. And it's a very liberal area in Northern California. And she said she was shocked at the, she called it the white savior perspective.
Yeah. Oh,
and she was just like, they were so clueless, but in their mind,
it's like you're living in a bubble of intentions, if that makes any sense at all.
With no real perspective of it. And it she says she was so infuriated because she was trying to share her experience and they were like discounting. They're like, no, that's, we're not like that. And no, we're, what are you saying? We're very accepting and this and that.
Well, and so, to say you're accepting does not mean you're not racist, right? This is the thing that I have really been thinking about a lot over the last few months. And again, once I found this Instagram account, I can be accepting, but still be racist. I can be accepting, but still be privileged, right? Mm-hmm. To even say that I am privileged doesn't make me a bad person that makes me honest about what's going on. And what I had found a lot was people unwilling to acknowledge that privilege or acknowledge their own biases, because we all have them. That's the truth. Part of being human is that we all have biases. And I think that this Instagram account, or even just looking at Northern California, I love it. It's an amazing place. I am so glad I grew up there. But there's a sense of, we still have to look at where we don't know everything. Just because you want to be accepting doesn't mean you always are.
Yeah, it's very, very true. Summer, did you have an experience with racism growing up? And what would you say your perspective as a white woman has been towards racism?
So mine is strange in that I was born in Florida to very Southern parents and very Southern grandparents. And then when I was 9 years old, we moved to Juneau, Alaska, which was a utopia. There was no racism there. At least that's what I grew up believing. Mm-hmm. Now that I'm a little bit older, I can look back and say, no, there was. It just wasn't, you know, when I thought of racism growing up, I thought of just like white people hating black people. There's a very large population of Alaska Natives in Alaska, and that's where the racism existed there. But because I didn't think of racism that way, I just thought of it as, you know, the Jim Crow era and slavery on, mm-hmm. that I wasn't experiencing it. And I have actually spoken with some of my friends who are black from back home, asking if they felt like there was racism, and they agree, like, no, they never felt judged or treated other until they got to the South, or, you know, the lower 48, what we call it. One of my friends went to college in California, and that was the first time she felt any sort of bias against her. I currently have a friend who's moving to Florida. It'll be his first time out of Alaska, like living out of Alaska. We are almost 40. And that's the thing he's scared of right now, is moving to the South and experiencing racism for the first time as an adult man and subjecting his teen son to racism in the South, which is a completely valid response. But I can say, looking back, did I experience it, or did I see it, or was I influenced by it? Yes, I was raised by Southern people and like Southern farmers. No. The N-word was thrown around in my family, racist jokes, which I laughed at. Like, I didn't realize that that's, you know, what that was until I got older. But I didn't realize that I had grown up with racism until I actually experienced it firsthand myself. My very first night at Auburn, I was with Jamal, who I had met at Camp War Eagle. He was a black man who was in the military. He was there on the GI Bill. And then my roommate, Emily, who was biracial. And they were asked to leave a frat party because they were both black, and I was told I could stay. And I said, F you, and I left with them. So that was my very first day in a really, truly Southern state at a Southern university, and experienced racism. I had seen it like with my own eyes for the first time ever, and realized at that point, like, oh, I have grown up with this. I just didn't realize that that's what that was.
Yeah, and Auburn has been quite notorious over the years for racial incidents, to say the least. But yeah. I had several friends go to Auburn in Alabama, their arch rival. But that's a Southern football thing.
It sure is.
Yeah, as you know, and both of you brought this up because I think it's really important to understand, is a lot of people try to say, oh, racism doesn't exist, because they think of it in the perspective of white people hating black people and being obvious and clear about it. When really nowadays, most of the racism that people experience are microaggressions.
Right.
And it's funny because after this, right after George Floyd's death and then the protests started, I hosted a conversation on a friend of mine's page. Her name is also Summer. And one of the things that came up is people not understanding what microaggressions are and having to explain, like,
how... As in they didn't think they existed?
They just didn't understand the overall concept of... What is a microaggression and how can you even say it's a microaggression, like being talked over when you're the only Black woman in the room, or little things like my son, I've had trouble with him being labeled as the trouble kid. And it's like things that you can pretty much tie to your race, but you can't tie down and point to it as racism, because a lot of the times they're based in biases that people have that they're not even aware of, that they're acting on and taking out on you. But as a Black person, you are very aware of the fact that it is because you are Black that you are being faced with this. Yeah. And I see it.
Now I'm like, oh no, now I just talked over you.
No, that's okay. This Zoom, we're doing this on a Zoom call, basically, and it's not easy to host. But the biggest place that I see it in is in dealing with school with my kids, especially my boys.
I see that a lot.
And that we, on the conversation with my fellow Mocha moms, each of them talked about that being an issue. But I think that microaggression piece is like, no, that is the cusp of where so many of these issues come from. It's like you reacting to someone based on a bias because you think that they're more aggressive, or you think that they're more dangerous, or you think that I'm going to be the Black bitch, that kind of stuff.
This is like, oh, this is my soapbox. I could talk about this in an entire podcast episode. So, this is something that I was very passionate about learning about as an educator. And the second part of my career, I was also an advocate for students with IEPs and 504s. Statistically, there is no way that you could argue that these biases are not affecting the school setting. 100%. They are. It is just like there's nothing to be said about it. Data doesn't lie. You know, and it's funny because I always say that when I speak on the internet, I try to speak about things that I'm an expert about or share experts about the other things, right? So as this conversation really started in June surrounding so many things in our country, I talked a lot about systemic racism in the education system because I felt like, okay, this is something that I can say from personal experience, from 15 years of studying it, from working with amazing experts at UCLA, from being a part of studies. People did not believe it was real. I am mind boggled by the messages I got in DMs. Systemic racism does not exist. That is not true anymore. That is not really true in the education system. I mean, there was a specific like slide that I posted a couple of times, and it just talked about the amount of students of color who see teachers that look like them.
Yep.
And how rare it is. And people argued with me that wasn't true. It is true. Think back to your teachers. I'm saying this as a white woman who was a teacher. Teachers are, the vast majority of them are white women. And the fact, I mean, that's just, look with your eyes. It's not that hard.
But yeah, I didn't have luck. I had two female Black teachers in elementary school, but I didn't have a Black male till my junior year. Mm-hmm. And my brother talks about how he never had a Black male professor, teacher at any point. He actually decided to become a teacher for a short amount of time through Teach for America because of that. Because it just, and here he is, he's a young Black guy. He's also fluent in Spanish, so he worked in a school in the Bronx. But it's just true. Like, you're in a system that does not reflect back to you who you are.
And the fact that we even still have to be arguing that point, this is the same thing as people not understanding what microaggressions are.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's rampant.
How are we still there? Like, over and over again, people are saying, growing up, I didn't have teachers who looked like me. It should be, okay, what can we do to change that experience for the next generation? No argument. No question.
Yeah, but right. And then these are conversations that people would not say that to me because they don't want to offend me. And I think right now we're in such a cancel culture that no one wants to say anything wrong because they're afraid. But I do want to hear from you ladies, like the conversations that are happening, like Summer, with your family. Like, what are people saying to you when you're having these conversations with them? Or what kind of questions do they have that they feel they can't ask in public? Because I think that's where, like, the deep work that can be done, that people can learn from each other, but they're not conversations that we're having with each other because they're scary and uncomfortable. And at this point, kind of, you take a risk.
Yeah, you do. I actually had a conversation with my dad yesterday, and we've had similar conversations before. And my dad is one of those folks who says, well, my best friend was Black. And yeah, I'm like, oh, okay, Dad. But he was a public servant for many years, firefighter, actually fire chief. So he was in the work of planning and all this other stuff and still denies any sort of mistreatment or gerrymandering or redlining or anything in these communities. And I don't know what to say to him because the things that I've said to him, he doesn't want to hear. He's part of what I see as a larger problem in his generation. And that's, they don't want to listen. They don't care what someone's experience was. And because his quote unquote best friend never explained his, you know, walk through this world as a Black man to my dad, who's a white man, it doesn't exist. And what I've tried to tell him is, well, maybe he just wasn't comfortable telling you his experience. Mm-hmm. Because how on earth would you have reacted to it? You've dismissed everything I've tried to say. And there's facts. Like, this, some of these things are fact. I don't know how you can deny it. And so the conversation I have with my kids is, the same thing. Like, we do talk about it. I am super honest with them about every time a Black person is murdered at the hands of police. We talk about the fact that they go to a school where people look just like them and that's not normal and that it's not okay. Like, diversity is extremely important to me. And it's one of the problems I really don't like living where we live because they're not exposed on a day-to-day basis to diversity. So we talk about it a lot because it's important to me that they know that they are not, like, I don't know. I don't want them to go to college one day and hang out with only white people. You know what I mean? Like, I want them to value diversity as much as I have. And so we talk about it and we talk about the injustices and I let them ask questions and we look for differences wherever we go.
It's interesting.
Go ahead, Carly.
I was going to say, it's interesting that these are the conversations that you are having in your house, because I have had like a totally flip side of this coin talking to my daughter, who is almost 7. So we moved a year ago. And when we looked for a home to buy, this is so California, I acknowledge that, I looked at the diversity of the schools so that we could pick a rich and diverse community for my daughter to go to school in. And I love her school, and it is amazingly diverse. There's something like 47 languages spoken there. It's phenomenal.
Wow.
So I have to be honest, I kind of a little bit felt like I'd done the work, if that makes any sense at all. And as all of this started to be talked about in the news more, she made this comment that shocked me and said, "Oh my gosh, this year is so awful, Mom. People have gotten the virus and they've caught racism." I was like, "Oh no, they didn't discuss it right now." As silly as that sounds, like that's what a six-year-old would say. I was like, "Oh my gosh, she didn't know about racism before we were talking about it," if that makes any sense at all. Like, she thinks they caught it in 2020, this ridiculous year that we're here we are. And I realized, like, I kind of thought that the living in a diverse place and having experiences and friends of many different backgrounds was enough. We weren't actually having these conversations with her.
It also brings up for me, Carly, that she is experiencing the world as a white girl. Like, I mean,
100%. She never had to learn about this before. Right? I mean, you know, like,
even though she's in a diverse school, it still is flying over her head because those aren't actually her experiences, which I don't know. It's so, it's really eye-opening to me just hearing you even saying it, because I can't have the experiences that my Black friends do. All I can do is listen to theirs, but I don't know how it feels because it's not my experience.
Well, and it's been, I mean, of course, then I went into like teacher mode, right? And was like, okay, we're going to have all these discussions around this now. It has been a very interesting dialogue in our household in a lot of ways. And she had a lot of questions that made me realize how important just opening up these conversations with our children, how important that is. You know, I mean, she kind of understood there was slavery, for instance, but she kept saying, but that was a really long time ago. Like, there was a disconnect going on because it is not her experience, because she does not live in a place where she has, to her knowledge, experienced racism. So for her to kind of start to ask these questions and understand was important. And it's been really interesting to me to compare a little bit to myself. What would this experience be like if my daughter wasn't white? Would we be having this conversation at age almost 7? Probably not, right? Like, we probably would have had quite a few dialogues around this already. And it really reminded me that I was resting on my laurels a little bit. Like, oh, we live in California. Oh, I've done this work as a teacher. Oh, I found this great school. But was I actually continuing to do the work in my own household that I needed to be doing?
It's such a, it's a hard line to toe, because, and especially being the mother of Black children, like, what conversations do I want to have? What do I want to expose them to? Where's the line between them being educated and, you know, maintaining some of the innocence that I think a 6-year-old, a 9-year-old, right, a 14-year-old should have? Like, how much do I protect them from what's happening right now? How do you even start those conversations? We actually had an incident with my 9-year-old, after George Floyd was murdered, that they were having a class Zoom, and a lot of the schools felt like they needed to address it. And the school he goes to is a Spanish immersion program. So there's a large number of Hispanic children. There's a good number of Black children. And so they were having the conversation, and then they showed a TED Talk given by a Black boy that must have been around, I don't know, 14 or 15 years old. And, you know, the kids had been on Zoom for 3 months. You're half paying attention to what's going on. And I walk by and I hear this kid talking about, you know, cops killing Black men. And I'm like, What are you watching? I didn't realize he was on a
Zoom. Was this TED Talk meant for kids, or was it meant?
It was a child giving the TED Talk. It was not an appropriate conversation for kids to be a part of. And so I sat there for a second, and like the kid is naming, you know, some of the people, some of the men who had been killed, and, you know, describing his point of view as a Black boy, which I don't know that I felt like he fully understood what he was saying. But I pulled my child off of the Zoom because I felt like, first of all, it wasn't the teacher's place to present that information. There was nowhere near enough context provided for a class of 9-year-olds to be able to really, really like break down what they're hearing and have a conversation about that. It really, really annoyed me. And I thought it was a little tone deaf, but I spoke directly with the teacher and also the principal of the school. And I understand that they were trying to really show kids what was happening. But I was like, okay, first of all, you have to let parents know, because it's really a parent's choice how they're going to present this to their children. And you have a Black boy telling my Black boy that he can be murdered by a cop. That's a conversation I want to have with my child.
Well, and I'm going to say, from the standpoint of someone that worked as an administrator in a school, that is not doing the work to do anti-racism at your school. You can't just pop a TED Talk up there for kids to watch, you know. As we're moving into the school year again, I think we're going to see schools do great things and we're going to see schools make missteps here. That's the truth, you know. This is where you do your research, and there are amazing experts out there who will help you navigate this when talking to kids. There just are. I mean, to just pop a video on doesn't seem...
It's irresponsible.
I applaud the wanting to have the conversation. I do. I think that that's very important. But what an interesting choice of content to show.
I did feel heard once we had the conversation and I let them know what the problems were with that. And I feel like it was properly addressed. But my initial reaction was just like, whoa. But it is such a difficult thing to figure out how to present this truthfully to children in an age appropriate way. And I think so many parents are struggling with that. And like, how do you have the conversation so that you know that they're absorbing real information as opposed to thinking, oh, I can catch racism, let me avoid that. Like, but
he was
so
really upset about it. You're like really, really upset.
Is there a vaccine for that? If there's a vaccine for that, I think everyone should get it at birth.
2021, it's all coming out.
That would be great. I call it education. That's what
yes,
exactly.
True.
I mean, speaking of, I will say the thing, this is so teachery yet again. I have done a lot of thinking about why she thought this, and I don't have a lot of answers, but the one thing that I have decided to do, in addition to the conversations we've already had, is I realized there was this disconnect for her between something that happened, quote unquote, so long ago, which was slavery, and how that's affecting like people she knows alive today, right? Mm-hmm. So we, in addition to all of the other lovely distance learning we are going to be doing, she's just going to learn about the history of slavery and what happened from when it started in the United States to present day slowly over the next year. Like, we're just going to take some time to really understand what has led our country to this point. Because I think children in general in the U.S., when you look at like the state, the Common Core standards for history, this isn't delved into very deeply. It's very much whitewashed, glossed over. It's all done now, right? Like we all learn about Ruby Bridges integrating one school and now it's all good or whatever. You know, I think part of this is that we have not acknowledged like a deep history of what has happened. So our children just don't have an understanding of what did happen and why this is still here. So I'm hoping, I mean, yes, she's six. We're not watching any TED Talks. Let me be quite clear about that. No TED Talks. But I think at least for her and for me as her mother, that's a place to start so that she has a deeper understanding of what has occurred.
Carly, what are you going to be using for that?
Oh, funny you asked. Yet again, so teachery, right? I have like a barrage of materials. My husband was like, your 75th book you ordered on Amazon just arrived. I literally will like talk all day about how I feel like children learn through literature and experiences. So we're not doing a history book. I have like a ridiculous library of children's literature that we are going to be delving into. We're doing like a whole unit with one of the American Girl dolls. We have like a million things. We're going to be taking virtual museum trips. Honestly, I think we're going to do something every day, whether it's, you know, watching a movie, reading a book, building a diorama, like one small thing every day, slowly but surely. I have, just to plug people on Instagram, started following a number of teachers I found who really focus on like diversity in literature. And it's something that I did do work around, but I'm not the expert here by a long shot. So I am leaning on these women and their amazing content they create. These are women that have been doing work specifically in this area for years. So pretty much every time they recommend a book, I'm like ordering it on Amazon.
Oh, you should send me that list and I'll add it to the notes.
I will give them to you. I'm their super fan.
That would be awesome. But even to be fair, like my kids aren't super educated about things and I find them saying things all the time. And I'm like, whoa, okay, time out. Wait a minute. Let's take a step back and have a conversation. Like, you know, when all of this started happening and the thing happened with my 9-year-old, my husband was like, we really need to start being a little bit more proactive about having conversations, you know, and really like at dinner time, trying to bring up things, really to hear what they think about it, because, you know, they've gotten this information either from school or friends or at this point, TikTok and YouTube.
I was going to say the internet.
Yeah. And it's like, What did you hear? Or like, you know, him making my 14-year-old making jokes about Kunta Kinte and like not understanding the connection to history. Like we have friends that are descendants of Alex Haley. So it's like they're relatives of his. So it's like, no, actually, we have direct connection. And let me go back. Oh, the eye rolls I've gotten from my 14-year-old about why I have to make everything a lecture. Well, but like they miss.
And my thing is, this is normal, right? 14-year-olds are going to learn from TikTok. That's just the truth. But I think as a parent, I want to arm my daughter with information so that when these other conversations happen, she can attach to them with historic facts, like actual information and a context, you know, because that will equip her to speak up and to navigate and to say, hey, that seems offensive because of A, B, and C, or it doesn't seem offensive. And here's why. I think if our kids don't even have that knowledge, how do we expect them to react?
Yeah,
exactly.
And like trying to figure out even like having my kids, my boys watch Hamilton. My daughter was having none of it because she said it was too long. But hearing their questions afterwards, like first them thinking like Hamilton was Hispanic or that. And it's like, no, you know, and talking about his act of choice to use people of color. And like it started opening all these conversations and questions about things that they probably would have never thought about, or I would never think to bring up because I don't understand where they're coming from. So like really trying to find ways to not just lecture them, but have a back and forth. Because I think as Black parents, that's a struggle we have too. Like helping them to understand what racism really is. Because I've heard my 14-year-old use it when I'm like, that's not racism. And I don't ever want you to use that word in a throwaway way, because racism is really serious. And like trying to sit down and to explain to him the difference between real racism and what he was referring to. So I think it's a struggle that, you know, both white parents and black parents are having. And how do we teach our kids that? But also, like, it helps you to recognize your own biases. And I'm wondering if during this time, have you guys had to confront any of your own biases?
I can say, I mean, and I know I've said this and I'll say it a million times more. I very much felt my work was quote unquote done. If you had asked me in May, I would have proudly told you about all the work I did in inner city schools and that I was a part of this special program at UCLA and talked to you about the diverse library that I had in my classroom. And I was very proud of that. And that's not to take away from what I did do, but I really felt like I didn't have anything more to learn, if I'm being candid and honest. Mm-hmm. And I think I have done a lot of work around other areas of my life besides what I did in the classroom. Like, that isn't the end for me. And one of my biggest things is really acknowledging privilege, like really acknowledging mm-hmm. what that looks like, because it's not that I didn't think I was privileged, but I don't think I loudly said it either. You know, and for me, that has been kind of the biggest, I guess, change in perspective or bias, is that I acknowledge that I'm privileged. That doesn't make me a bad person. That is the truth of the system that I am a part of. We are all a part of this system. And for me to really wrestle with that and realize not only is it okay to say that, but it's important to say it, has been a big shift for me.
That, I think, acknowledging your own biases and your own privilege is the first step to recognizing the opposite of your experience. Like, right. You can't see it if you don't acknowledge your own privilege. Summer, right. I'm wondering if you've had any biases you've had to confront.
What this has brought up for me is that it's not enough to be having the conversations with my Black friends. I have to be doing the work in my own community too, like with the white people. I need to be talking to these people and not just speaking from an area of emotion, because I am very driven by emotion in these conversations. Mm-hmm. It's learning how to bring facts into the conversation and to take the stories that I do have from my friends and to bring them into the forefront and have the hard conversations with folks who don't believe that racism is a thing. And like Carly, acknowledging that I have privilege has been a gap, I would say, for me in the past. It's been like, well, I'm doing this, I'm having these conversations and I'm fighting the good fight without recognizing the fact that, like, yeah, I'm a white woman and I do have privilege, and knowing the stories is not the same as experiencing the stories. Mm. And I think that that was a place where I was kind of failing, especially failing my Black friends, like not acknowledging that, like, I don't know what you're going through, but I'm here to listen. And then aside from just listening, like spreading the word and talking to the folks who need to be hearing it.
Well, I can't tell you, ladies, how much I appreciate you having this conversation and sharing your open and honest perspectives. I really feel like this is where the groundwork that we have to do in order for people to really be able to move forward and make change. Is there any last thing you ladies would like to share with this conversation?
Thank you for having this with us. I mean, I feel like these conversations need to be happening a lot more than they are.
Yes,
you know? Absolutely. I agree. Yeah. Yes. And thank you so much for inviting us to have this conversation and let us say any of the hard things that do come up. I could do this again, like three more times.
I know. I've in my head been going through a possible way to open this up to a larger group, because I really believe that moms can be at the center of this, because we're raising the children, we're in the schools, we're in the workplaces, and we're very active voices. And when more moms support moms, we mean business. And if we can really, really support each other, but that would call for conversations, hard conversations, admitting biases, admitting hurt, admitting anger. So I hope to continue these conversations for sure. And thank you, ladies, so, so very much.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me for this episode of More Than Just Mom. Be sure you take a moment to hit that subscribe button. And if you enjoyed this episode, go ahead and share it with your friends. Also, you can follow us at The Mom Forum on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, or visit the blog at themom-forum.com to check out our recent blog posts, shop our products, or join our self-care challenge. Thank you, and I look forward to you joining me for another episode of More Than Just Mom.